Thank you very much, Jim. We're very privileged to have with us, as I mentioned, a distinguished panel of experts in a range of fields of criminal justice. In your packets, you'll find information on each of their backgrounds. Each has kindly agreed to speak briefly on Jim's work and topics related to our theme today. Just as Jim's new book, Crime, includes a diversity of views on the complex issue of crime, our panel today also represents a range of backgrounds and approaches. I'd first like to introduce Judge Joseph Sneed, who is Circuit Judge for the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. Formerly, he was Deputy Attorney General for the U.S. Department of Justice. He's a graduate of the University of Texas Law School and Harvard University. Judge Sneed has been President of the Executive Committee for the Association of American Law Schools and a member of the California Law Revision Commission, the Select Committee on Supreme Court Procedures, and the Independent Counsel Panel of the Court of Appeals of the District of Columbia. Judge Sneed.
Yes, please. Mr. Wilson, I want to congratulate you for being a kind of leader in the true sense of the term in this country's struggle with the problem of crime and family structure and its future. My business primarily deals with the criminal side. The criminal caseload in the federal courts has increased enormously since I came on the court in 1973. Indeed, much of our business now deals with criminal law. I, too, have very little hope that criminal law is going to change the second problem that Mr. Wilson addressed, that is, the problem of the family. I think his focus is correct, and that being on the children. I do think, however, he neglected to point out that part of the reason for the decline of the family goes back to the fact that it is no longer regarded as a sacrament in the religious sense. It is regarded as a status one can choose or not, as the case may be. It is also true that the family has ceased to be the kind of self-supporting unit that it was in rural times. One looks at a family today, and the mother may work, the father certainly works, and the child from our children, from time to time, are cared for by others. No one of the units really depends upon the other. It is a kind of artificial gathering maintained by culture and habit, tradition. We don't have the thing that holds it together. Now, Professor Wilson is correct that the focus has to be upon children. And I would suggest the focus also perhaps ought to be on the men. How do you get them back? Is it at all possible? I don't know. But I do know they're not there now, whether some kind of subsidization of their attendance to their duties would help, I don't know. But I do know this, that Professor Wilson is correct in his suggestion that we take the mother and the child and put them in an environment where the child can be protected and developed. And I would urge that the money we want to spend in this area ought to go in part focusing on the man, but in also, and even if you forego the former, on the children. Care for them at public expense. See that they get pediatric care. See that they are screened for capacity as early as possible, and that they are followed, and the bright ones are insured admission into schools, not on affirmative action basis, but on the mere fact that they're as good as anybody else. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Judge Sneed. Our next panelist is Joe McNamara, who is a research fellow at the Hoover Institution and for 15 years was the chief of police for the city of San Jose, California. He received his PhD in public administration from Harvard University with Jim Wilson, and he's also served as deputy inspector for criminal analysis for New York City and police chief for Kansas City, Missouri. He's the author of several books, and his articles and commentary appear in many media, major media outlets. I'm pleased to introduce Joe McNamara.
Thank you. Of course, you just heard one of Jim Wilson's most closely held secrets, that I was one of his students, disclosed here. But I have to say he was a rather odd professor at Harvard. For a member of the faculty, he actually taught classes. And I was one of those very fortunate people who had a chance to attend them and to learn a lot of things that were, I thought, very realistic compared to some of the the more abstract academic presentations related to crime and public policy. And Jim Wilson has, of course, continued to be outstandingly stubborn in writing in English and speaking in English all of these years, despite some of his colleagues. I'd like to talk just for a moment about community policing, because as Professor Wilson said, this 800-pound gorilla of the federal government is now spending billions of dollars of your money on something called community policing. Last year, I was driving in that upscale community down the road, Palo Alto, and I pulled up to a red light, and a moment later, a police car pulled up next to me with a uniformed officer behind the wheel. And I glanced over, and there on the door of the police car was a sign that said, Community Service Officer. I looked at that sign for a moment, and I had this tremendous temptation to ask the police officer, whom do the other officers serve? However, there is one piece of expert advice that I have for you this morning, and that is limit the amount of communication that you have when you're behind the wheel of a vehicle with police officers. So I never did ask him, but I do a lot of research throughout the country, and in many cities, including this one that we're in this morning, after you ride with the officers on patrol for a while, you slip in a question, what do you think of community policing? And if you've properly convinced them that you can be trusted to speak the truth to, they will quickly tell you, well, we answer the calls and we do the police work, and the community police officers attend meetings. So what you're finding there is the gap between this panacea that is being presented and the reality of policing. Now, one is hard-pressed to get a universal definition of community policing, despite the fact that billions of dollars have been allocated to this by the federal government. In general, they will say that it's a partnership with the community, and it's planning an active role. Well, in my experience, both as police chief and since then, this steps on a lot of toes. It steps on the toes of the police bureaucracy, and it certainly creates a great deal of uneasiness in City Hall. My Mayor Tom McHenry was very supportive of the community policing that we had in San Jose, but some of his colleagues on the city council were very threatened by it, because you're talking about a grassroots kind of political movement that goes far beyond policing. And I think, as Professor Wilson indicates, that if we're going to see any significant change in crime in America, we're going to have to see some cultural changes. And that doesn't come from government. That comes from the communities themselves. The real challenge, I guess, to government is to find ways to encourage those positive changes, and not to be fooled by the easy, quick slogans that locking up more people, building more prisons are the answer. It certainly is part of the answer, and we need to do a much better job, I think, at focusing on the really violent offenders and making sure that they are locked up. My problem with the crime bill is we spend $30 billion subsidizing what, by and large, is inefficient law enforcement across America, cops making hundreds of thousands of marijuana arrests a year. And Mark Kloss is here, and a tragic personal experience. I don't wish to add to his grief, but the fact is that, Mark, in America, that you will find that there are some 20 times more officers assigned to traffic enforcement, 10 times more officers assigned to investigate narcotics, nonviolent narcotics crimes, than there are assigned to look for missing children. So at a time when America is concerned about violence, it seems to me that we need to pay a little better attention to what not just the police, but the other agencies of criminal justice are doing in setting priorities, and not merely to throw some money at these problems from Washington. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Joe. Our next panelist is Bill Koch, who I introduced briefly before. Bill is the president of the Oxbow Group of Companies and chairman of the Koch Crime Commission for the state of Kansas. The commission was established by Governor Joan Finney in February 1994 to assess crime reduction and prevention strategies. He received his PhD from MIT, and he's a recipient of the 1994 Carl Menninger Award for his work in examining crime problems. He's probably most widely known, though, for having won the 1992 America's Cup, and his current rather historic sponsorship of the all-women's team at present in San Diego to defend the cup. Bill?
First of all, I'll give you a report on the racing in San Diego. The women have a fast boat. They're getting a faster one, which will be much faster than the challengers and the other defenders, and the women are tough enough to win, so. I would like to compliment Jim Wilson. All of his books and all of his articles are required reading for each member of our crime commission, primarily because he tries to look at crime in a rational way, not in a philosophical or in a religious way, which I think it's got to be that's absolutely necessary to solve it. There are a couple of things I'd like to augment what he has said, and that is something about the probability of getting caught in a our studies by a criminal. Our studies have shown that for every 1,000 crimes committed, only 400 are reported to the police. Of those 400, only about 200 result in arrest, and of those 200 arrests, only 8 lead to a conviction. So if you look at it, there is a 99.2% chance that you're going to get away with a crime if you commit it. And if I look at that as a businessman, I'd take those odds any day of the week. One other thing that we found is interesting, it's come out a lot of work has been confirmed over and over, is that 7% of the criminals commit 70% of the crimes, and they average on their average amount of crimes per year per one of these criminals is 180. Another very startling statistic in the state of Kansas, I should tell you, is that the rate of violent growth or of violent crimes committed by kids 8 to 14 years old is 32% compounded annually. the rate of violent crimes committed by kids from 0 to 8 years old in the state of Kansas is growing at the rate of 22% compounded annually. You look at that, we're sitting on a time bomb of these kids that are growing up thinking that crime and violence and theft is a way of life. They're going to become these 7% who are causing 70% of the crimes. Now, there's a real reason for it, if you think about it, and most of these kids are in gangs. The gangs have become the family. The gangs are run by OGs, old gang members, who look at these young kids as a business opportunity because the juvenile justice system does not punishes kids much less than the adult justice system, and they use these young kids to go out and perform all the heinous crimes. And they've put in a system which is pretty interesting, in that the higher the kid's rep or his reputation depends entirely upon the most heinous crime that he can commit. The system in ourself is that way we've looked at it is absolutely goofy and absurd. There are incentives for kids to commit crime and for criminals to exist. And the reason for that is we believe, when we've just looked at the state of Kansas, which is a very simple, relatively simple environment, there are laws in the state and tools in the state to solve all of its crime problems. It doesn't. And the reason it doesn't is because of one simple thing, bureaucratic turf and lack of accountability. There's a law in the state of Kansas that says schools and the Justice Department must share information. They don't even talk to one another. They have a computer system. They have 8 databases that won't even interact with one another, and they're 2 years out of date. Even the local police in Wichita, Kansas, hired a known felon out of the state of Nebraska to be one of their officers. One other thing that's interesting about this lack of accountability is that you look at the police. The police of Olathe, Kansas spend 7% of their time, only 7% of their time dealing with crime. The rest of it they spend in dealing with the bureaucracies and other social services that they're required. In fact, the police in Kansas view their customers as the state bureaucrats and the federal bureaucrats who give them grants. I firmly believe that the problem of crime can be solved. However, the government won't solve it. The people have to solve it. The people who have neighborhoods and have families. I'll just say one last thing that's interesting. The most effective group in fighting gangs has been an organization in Baltimore called Grandmothers Against Gangs. And they go out when any time they see a bunch of kids together selling drugs on a street corner, they run out with brooms and chase them away. So that gives me great hope. If we could get the government out of our lives, you know, and get it efficient, we could do it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bill. Our next panelist is Robert Higgs. Bob is the research director for the Independent Institute. He received his PhD in economics from Johns Hopkins University. He's been a visiting scholar at Oxford University and Stanford. He's been a fellow at the Hoover Institution and the National Science Foundation. He's the author of numerous books, including the book Arms, Politics, and the Economy, published by the Institute. I'm very privileged to introduce Bob Higgs.
Crime is a terribly big and difficult subject, and Professor Wilson has given us a number of very wise and provocative observations, particularly with regard to cultural decay and the role of the underclass in the increasing crime rates. I want to speak in the next 2.5 minutes about something that Professor Wilson only touched upon, but which I think is a central aspect of the crime problem plaguing the United States right now. Let me just string together three quotations, two from a chapter in the book Crime, edited by Professor Wilson, and one from his article, which you had in your packets. First, from Boyum and Kleiman's chapter in the book Crime, they say there are more than a million drug arrests a year in the United States. Without question, this imposes a tremendous burden on police, courts, and prisons. It's noted in Professor Wilson's article that by 1994, 60% of all federal and about 25% of all state prisoners were there on drug charges. And finally, back in Boyum and Kleiman, again, we have a statement that more crimes, and especially violent crimes, are committed under the influence of alcohol than under the influence of all illegal drugs combined. I'm trying to provoke your thinking about drugs and about whether the great problems we face with crime in the United States today may have something to do with the fact that some drugs have been made illegal, even though tens of millions of Americans want to use these substances. And so we have an enormous illegal black market flourishing. It's clearly a market that cannot be suppressed without truly extraordinary and draconian means being taken. I only hope that such means will never be resorted to. Back in the Vietnam War, opponents of the war sometimes urged that the way to get out of the quagmire was to declare victory and leave. And I'd like to suggest that that might be a way to make a great contribution to the crime problem by declaring these drugs and the use and transacting in them no longer be crimes, and thereby to create a lot of good along with what many would argue would be some bad. Professor Wilson noted that he would like to see the demand for drugs reduced, and that one way to do that includes use of prisons. I'd like to just observe that tens of millions of people use drugs, if not regularly, at least episodically, and that the great, great majority of those drug users do not commit crimes, that placing drug users and drug dealers in prison is a kind of prior restraint that seems to me to run wholly against our legal traditions and belief in due process by imprisoning people who have deprived no one else of their rights merely by the use or transaction in drugs. I think that war on drugs is doing tremendous harm to our Constitution in combination with asset forfeiture laws. We've created a disastrous set of incentives for police authorities all over the country who sometimes mistakenly and sometimes by design are committing what in all rights ought to be classified as crimes themselves, but are not being so classified. So I think we're moving toward a very ironic situation, which is we're moving toward creating a police state in the United States without doing anything in the process to suppress the use of drugs and the transacting in drugs that ostensibly justifies this war. I think we ought to consider declaring victory and leaving.
Thank you, Bob. Our next speaker is Don Cates. Don is a San Francisco criminologist and civil rights and constitutional lawyer. He's a graduate of Yale Law School. He completed civil rights work in the South and worked with New York lawyer William Kunstler. He subsequently served as director of legal research with California Rural Legal Assistance and the San Mateo County Legal Aid Society. His books include Restricting Handguns, The Liberal Skeptics Speak Out, and Firearms and Violence. Don?
I want to expand on some remarks that Professor Wilson has made on the subject of gun control. 25 years of serious research has forced criminologists, often very reluctantly, to four very negative conclusions about gun control. First, there is no persuasive evidence that having guns causes ordinary law-abiding people to commit crimes, although it certainly does allow criminals to commit crimes that they were otherwise inclined to commit. It is a myth that murders occur because law-abiding people have a gun available when they get mad. Every homicide study shows that murderers are very extraordinary people with lifelong records of felony, violence against those around them, drug abuse, and dangerous accidents, both with guns and with cars, and so on. It is also the case that people who have fatal gun accidents have the same kind of background. What acquaintance homicide actually means is not responsible people killing each other, but rather abusive men eventually killing the women they have beaten on innumerable prior occasions, and gangs and organized crime figures killing each other, drug addicts and drug dealers killing each other, so on. Second, the value of firearms in defending victims has been greatly underestimated. The best available evidence shows that guns are used approximately three times as often by law-abiding citizens to defeat crime as by criminals to commit crime. Third, the theoretical value of gun control is undercut by the difficulty of enforcement. Unfortunately, there is an almost perfectly inverse correlation between who we want to disarm and who we can disarm. Yes, lots of law-abiding people will give up guns if we pass a law against guns. That will do no good at all. What would do good would be to take the guns out of the hands of the criminals, but unfortunately, that is unlikely. The leading English analyst of gun control comments pessimistically, quote, "In any society, the number of guns always suffices to arm the few who want to obtain and use them illegally," unquote. So the fourth conclusion, which criminological research forces upon us, is that yes, if we have gun controls that are targeted only at criminals, those laws can do some good, but they will only do a marginal amount of good, because unfortunately, we cannot enforce them against criminals any better than we can enforce the rest of the laws that the criminals are violating. I want to move briefly to another topic, drug laws, on which I wish most respectfully to disagree with Professor Wilson, and also to some extent with my predecessors, that is Mr. Higgs. The civil liberties costs of our failed drug war are prohibitive. I say that very reluctantly. I am a liberal, not a libertarian. I do not think there is any liberty to take drugs. I do not think putting criminals in jail for taking drugs is a bad thing. I would be absolutely delighted if we could abolish the drug culture, but we can't.
Our last panelist is Chris Killo. Chris is the chairman of Phoenix Operations, a private security firm based here in San Francisco. He's a former police officer in San Francisco and a correctional officer for the California Department of Corrections. Sorry about that. Mr. Killo was the recipient of many awards for his police work, including the Citizens Meritorious Award from the City of San Francisco and the Proclamation Honor for Outstanding Contributions to the City and the County of San Francisco. Chris?
thank you. It's quite a humbling experience to sit up here as a former police officer, and basically I'm the owner of a guard company, a former prison guard, with such a distinguished group of scholars. And I also, as I talked to the people at the table where I had lunch and looked around, I realized that I'm probably way out of my league. And the best thing I can do is to speak a little bit from my own experience on the line as a prison guard, a correctional counselor, a deputy sheriff, a private security officer, moonlighting while I was a police officer, and then for the last 8 years, the owner and president of a rapidly growing security guard firm. As was alluded to earlier, we are in a growth industry, and I don't delight in that. Most of my life I have spent dealing with the symptoms of crime. And it was only approximately 3 or 4 years after I had gotten involved as a peace officer that I realized that as a correctional officer, for example, we were only dealing with the symptoms of crime. When I was a correctional counselor and I studied the what we used to call the B files, which were the case histories of these men at San Quentin where I worked, the typical convict there, we called them, I forgot what we had, we weren't supposed to call them convicts, but that's what they were, was about this thick. And it was like a history. Reading these case files was like a history of these men's lives. And it was heartbreaking. And what I found just experientially proved to be true as I began studying the criminal problem. I started studying it really officially when the warden of San Quentin, George Sumner, commissioned me to write a kind of a brief history of San Quentin for the prison. So I got very interested in the study of criminology and penology and whatnot. What I found, and this was reinforced by Professor Wilson, is that the vast majority of the people that I was dealing with were unwanted children. They, at some point, they were just as innocent as my little two-year-old boy is, but nobody wanted them. And these children grew up in fragmented, totally disenfranchised environments, and they became criminals. Now, I believe that probably is the root cause, as has been referred to several times, for most of our crime. It's this whole the AFDC. It's supporting a whole criminal effort. But on the other hand, only about 7% of the people are committing most of the crimes. And so even in this huge underclass, it's still a relatively smaller minority that is committing most of the crimes. There has been some talk of prisons. What good do prisons do? I thought that it was particularly important that Mr. Professor Wilson pointed out that the observation that I hear so often and I find so infuriating is that we have more people in prison in America than so many other places in the world. Well, it is a symptomatic treatment to a problem, but there's one thing that I know for sure, and that's that while those people are in prison, they're not committing crimes. When they are out of prison, they're committing crimes. I learned this from the prisoners that I worked with at San Quentin. They told me this. They said, the day I hit the streets, I'm going to start robbing again, because the first thing I want to do is I want to get another shot of heroin or cocaine or whatever it is that they enjoyed so much that caused them to commit crimes all day long, every day of their life when they were awake, to supply themselves with their dope. And that touches on the subject of legalization. My time is up. I would like to hear more on this debate. I must frankly tell you that I'm undecided on that issue. Most of the people I dealt with in my life as a police officer were people who abused drugs or alcohol. So there is a big question there, and there might be something to the argument for legalization. The other thing that I want to touch on would be my last comment, and I was particularly glad that someone, Mr. Cates, I believe, brought up the problem we're facing with police state and the misuse of the bureaucratic law enforcement element of our government to police crimes. What I found in the police department, for example, is that out of 2,000 police officers, we only had about 300 or 400 police officers on the street at any time. And there were only 800 assigned to the street. And of that 800, about a third of them were supervisors. So that's something to think about. I mean, we were paying these people I was getting about $25 an hour when I left, not counting overtime. When I drove down Market Street on the way to this meeting today, I saw cops about every 3 or 4 blocks. They're all on overtime. What were they doing? They're making sure that cars don't drive into the holes on the street. Anyway, those are some of my comments, and I'll...
Thank you, Chris.